Yes, sir.
Hassan, Hassan. What's up, bro?
What's good, bro? Damn, you got your name behind you, too, just so people don't forget?
Hey, man, my homeboy, he went to CVS and picked up some Sharpies. And I picked up some Crayolas. So he did this sign with the Sharpie, and I did this with the Crayola. And, you know.
It's two different signatures.
Hey, he gave it to me as a present, and I was like, you know, I appreciate it, and so I'll put it up because, you know.
So, Justin, you're having a baby shower, right?
That's
the baby shower.
That's right. The only problem is the baby's not mine. man, we here with, say, how you, Hassan, Hassan.
I cannot. Yeah, you got it. You got you. I got you. Yeah.
We here with Hassan. I got to say it the American Negro way. We here with Hassan Minaj, man, Urban Legends Podcast. I want you to know, bro, the reason I created this podcast, I had wanted to do it for like 2 years, and I didn't have time to do it until the COVID shit happened. And the reason I started it, because I wanted to celebrate people that I consider are living legends and people making legendary moves in their career. And, you know, we go back, like.
Bro. Bro, come on now.
Open mic days. Decade, over a decade.
Over a decade, bro.
Yeah, man. And so, you know, we came up together, man. And I remember, like, doing open mics with you and everything like that. So I kind of want to get into your, you know, your background and everything like that and your story. You know, I know some things, but I don't know a lot of things post the celebrity. You know what I'm saying? And that's what I want to kind of dive into also. But I thought it was interesting. So you grew up in what, Northern California?
I grew up in Northern California, yeah. You know what's so crazy, bros? Whenever you say that stuff, you're just like, oh, the celebrity stuff. It's like, you don't think about it, bro. Like, I remember when you were doing 21 Jump Street, I'm like, bro, he's in a major motion picture. Like, yo, Justin's a celebrity, you know? Or when you were doing Rush Hour, I was like, yo, he's on the CBS lot. He's number one on the call sheet. Justin is a celebrity. But in your mind, you're just like, you're the protagonist in your own little video game. So you're like, nah, this is all just kind of part of, you know what I mean? And you got kids at home. You're just playing out this little video game as your avatar. You don't realize your avatar, the perception of your avatar is changing with other people.
Straight up.
Whenever you're just like, oh, you blow up on me. I'm like, bro, you know me from Diversity Showcase. Like, what are you talking about? This is not a real, but maybe that's the thing, like with some of your other friends. I don't know. I'm like, but that's just not a real thing to me. But yeah, man.
Hold on, before you get into that, yes, yeah. And I want to ask you that. I mean, I'm going to get back to the other stuff, but I have seen some people switch up. I've seen some people switch up, some people that I've known from the open mic days when they get a TV show, when they get something, they harder to access and they start being more distant. And I'm a type of person where I'm like, yo, I'm already working. Like, I've been working. I've been on TV. Might have been on TV before you. And if you are getting it and you that hot dude right now, that's cool. But don't think I'm not going to also, like, I'm not one thing away from Justin being out of here.
Right.
So have you ever experienced that, though? You haven't experienced that in your career yet?
Man, I got a little bit more of a measured approach. Yeah, there's a lot of, like, guards and shields that people put up. But the thing that I think you also got to recognize too is you don't know what another person's going through. For a lot of people, everybody sees the Deadline article, everybody sees the Variety article. Man, you don't know what that person's going through in their marriage, with their kids. They might have a divorce settlement. They might have, you know, there's a million things. They might got a family member that's sick. There's a million things that that, you know, lights, camera, action, and the gram and the algorithm doesn't show you.
I had sent him a text the other day. That's his manager telling him to please get off this conversation. His publicist is like, no, please.
Get out of this.
Get out of this. It's going too deep too fast.
No, funny enough, bro, that's wifey. I gotta set this to do not disturb. How do I do that? Let me do that. Do not disturb.
Shout out to wifey. We were just having that conversation about relationships, me and my homeboy, about relationships, people that contact each other all throughout the day. And I'm not like that with my wife. Like, we just talk at the end. And I like that. I like that we only talk at the end of the day. But I said, I think most relationships, the husband and wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, they talk all throughout the day. How do you like that, Hassan?
I don't like it. As I'm messaging, I'm like, yo, I'm on a Zoom with a homie. Let me call you in 45 minutes.
Right.
It's interesting, bro. I mean, how many do you got? You got two or one?
I just got one. And she's 8 now.
Yes. Oh, bro. Yeah. You grew up fast. I got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old. So we got a newborn. So we're in that age where like any call could be anything. You know what I'm saying? That might be on set. And it might be a text like, yo, we need to talk. And it's one of those things I'm like, all right, I got to figure out what's happening on the ground. Like I all civilians alive. Like, that's the sort of like thing that I got to check in on. You know what I mean?
Yeah, nah, straight up. I feel you on that. So yeah, man, I want to get into the backstory. So I thought it was very interesting. I listened to your episode with Kevin Hart, which was a great, great episode that y'all did on his podcast, Comedy Goldmines. Great, great, great one. And I thought it was interesting because I didn't know you was on the debate team, and I didn't know you. I think you talked about how when you saw Chris Rock for the first time, you thought that he was doing like comical debate or something. Or
I was like, bro, he's just doing funny speech and debate. Everyone was like, he's the greatest comedian of all time. I'm like, bro, he's on the forensics team. He's just being funny. He's just like doing funny forensics.
So how did that then lead to you calling the comedy club? Because I want people to hear the backstory before we go into like the future.
Yeah, so you know, we're roughly the same age, right? So
we are. I didn't know that either, but we are.
Yeah. We're 80s, 90s kids, right? So we grew up in that era, and a lot of our like the seminal comedy that like shaped our generation, whether it was like Def Jam, The Simpsons, South Park, all like Family Guy, all that sort of stuff. All those Comedy Central Presents specials, BET Comic View. We didn't have cable in the house. Like my mom was super strict with us. She let me do other things, but she thought like cable would rot my mind. Like the same way parents think about social media. She's like, any kid with cable is not going to get good grades. They're going to be up all night watching crazy stuff on cable television. So I missed that whole era. I didn't see like all those seminal comedy specials, right? And I missed Chappelle's Show. Like I was a senior in high school. I was becoming a freshman. And then when I decided to do comedy, when everybody was illegally downloading stuff in college my freshman year, I Googled how to be a comedian. The local comedy club had this comedian performing there. Google told me, if you want to be a comedian, you call your local comedy club, ask them to perform. So I called, I said, hey, I noticed Dave Chappelle's performing. Can I open for Dave Chappelle? And they hung up on me, and I called back, and I'm like, excuse me, I would like to open for Dave Chappelle, you know? And they kept thinking I was fucking with them. And I eventually went down to the club, and they were like, yo, are you the Dave Chappelle kid? And I was like, yeah. And they're like, his name's Dave Chappelle. And I didn't know all this stuff. So I ended up kind of having to, download all that stuff. I put it in my brain, and I was able to contextualize it. Like, oh, this is what sketch comedy is, and this is what this is. And what's kind of cool about that, I didn't know this at the time, is it gave me a really beautiful blank slate. So I was able to start really fresh and kind of with a new, fresh perspective. I didn't know that at the time, but it helped a lot. You know what I mean?
That's fire, bruh. So he was calling and trying to open up for Dave Chappelle. He didn't even know. So you didn't even know who he was.
I didn't really know who he was. And then when I saw at the club, I was like, oh, bro, it's the guy from You've Got Mail.
Right, not Half-Baked.
Oh, the treadmill guy from You've Got Mail. Tom Hanks, you got to talk to her. And he's like, what? Like, I was like, oh, it's the treadmill guy. Oh, cool. You know what I mean? I didn't know.
And it's crazy how that's a memorable scene. That's a very memorable scene for whatever reason, because that scene stands out, him on the treadmill with Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks, yeah.
So, okay, so you had that blank slate. So then once you Google how to be a comedian, yeah, then what comedians did you say, okay, who did you resonate with? Or like, what comedians did you start like researching to be like, okay, I like what this comedian is doing versus I don't really like what this comedian is doing?
Yeah, man. So I just went down the entire rabbit hole. So this was early YouTube days, remember? Like, so you would just see a viral clip of stand-up. So I would see people like Patrice O'Neill, Greg Giraldo. I started seeing, you know, like Jon Stewart clips, Stephen Colbert clips. So those two things, I saw all these like beasts in the clubs really start to blow up, whether it was Patrice, Giraldo, Bill Burr, like they really started taking off. And then I saw these guys, you know, I was in college at the time. And, you know, when you're in college, everybody's starting to establish their political views. And that's when I saw Colbert Report and I saw, you know, The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. But I was so blown away by the Colbert Report. That was the first time I saw someone like double down on a character.
Right.
He's playing that he like Stephen was fully committed to this conservative news pundit character. And I just would watch just as a thought experiment of like, yo, how is he going to take the conservative position on this? Like, there was just a school shooting. How is he going to like take a conservative position? You know, it was really interesting to see. And that all just shaped me while I was in undergrad. And then, you know, ironically enough, what ended up happening was, you know, I started to research it more and other YouTubers started blowing up. I don't know if you remember, there was a thing called Derek Comedy with like, yep, Lover and his crew. And I said, oh man, people are shooting sketches. And so that 4 years in college was just like a real good, almost like comedy undergrad for me in a way, where I was just, you know, taking my early classes about what that was. And then I started to try to just, hey, if I do this, I need to learn how to shoot. I need to learn how to edit. I should take acting classes. And I started doing that my junior and senior year. But that was a massively profound time of my life, bro.
Wow. And yeah. So,
I mean, what about you? I felt like you were always like a theater kid, right?
Yeah, I went to a performing arts high school. So that was kind of I already had like the training background when it came to acting. And then when I came up here I'm in Atlanta right now. Yeah. But when I went to college here also. And yeah, while I was doing college, I was able to book
You went to Clark University, right?
Yeah, Clark, Atlanta. Uh-huh. And I landed 2 movie roles while I was here. Right. Linked up with MTV. MTV made me a video jockey for their college network, MTVU, because they saw me hosting my campus radio station.
When you landed that stuff, were you like, bro, I'm hot? Like,
I did. I was like, I'm the hottest nigga out here, and I need everybody to kiss my ass. That's it. Fucking with me. I wasn't like that, man. I'm the most, but everyone else saw it that way. It's like what you said earlier about the whole celebrity thing. So, yeah, I'm the kid on campus that was in Stomp the Yard. You know what I'm saying? I'm the kid on campus that they're literally seeing footage of me in Cancun interviewing Young Jeezy and Akon, you know, and they like, how the fuck are you accomplishing all of this? And you 2021, you know, we just trying to pass our classes, you know, our exam. So it was crazy. But I always tell people this now, though. I've always been the popular kid in school.
Wow. I can see that. Like you like the charisma, the charm, you're cracking jokes, you're getting along with everybody.
Right. However, in Hollywood has always made me feel like the least successful. Like, so I've always been popular until I got to Hollywood. And that's when I start to experience like, oh, this is how like the other kids at school used to feel, like not being the go-to guy, like not being Mr. Charismatic or whatever the case is, you know? And so that was a humbling thing for me, like, okay. And that also taps into why I work so hard also. But getting to LA, I didn't have any credit. So I was on YouTube super early. Because when I got on YouTube, all I saw was Donald Glover, like black people. I only saw Donald Glover and Afion Crockett. And then I put out some videos. Some of those went viral. You know what I'm saying? And it is what it is. But I know you was doing that too. So you started putting your videos out in college or when you got to LA?
I met a close friend in college, and we would do these things. You know, every year AT&T did this thing called Campus Movie Fest. I mean, this is like really in the weeds, but they went to campuses and like the best short film on campus would get an iPod Touch. I know, bro, this is dating me. Like, everyone's listening like, yo, an iPod Touch. I'm telling you, like, that was like a big deal. And we ended up winning Campus Movie Fest my junior year of college. And I just remember thinking like, oh, bro, like, you know, I was the president of we didn't have a comedy club. So I started a comedy club. We were called Gridiron Gang. It was 3 of us, and they gave us funds. I could book acts to come perform at the school. So like people, you know, we were in Davis. I would call, you know, some of the local comedians in San Francisco. Hey, will you come perform at UC Davis? So Ali Wong came down. This was before she really blew up. W. Kamau Bell, he came down. They were all in San Francisco at the time. And so I became that kid on campus who was like performing in the coffee house and then hosting the shows, you know, like hosting the big headlining acts. And then when we won Campus Movie Fest, I was like, man, this is kind of a big deal. And started to, with a buddy of mine, put some videos out on YouTube. And then when I got to LA and things weren't really clicking, then I met up with Fahim and Aristotle and Asif, and we put together this thing called Goatface, and we started doing sketches together. And then we eventually got a Comedy Central special out of it. But yeah, that was my first entryway and kind of like independently making my own little films, shorts. I mean, real talk, that's how I got The Daily Show. I shot my own field piece. I shot my own like audition with the green screen. I kind of created my own little reel if I was a correspondent on the show. So that all went back to college, just kind of having that industrious nature to be like, all right, I have this little goal and I'm going to shoot it and I'm going to put my heart and soul into it and see what happens, you know?
Yeah, man. And it paid off big, man. I still remember, that's actually something I'm about to get in the process of doing, a shooting something, because some people are interested about something, but I gotta do the work, you know? And that's something I admired about you so much. Number one, I remember the day you told me you got The Daily Show.
Wow.
I still remember it because, man, I was like, I don't know if you, sometimes it could take an outside person to kind of see something in you or whatever. And I always knew that was going to be your trajectory.
Wow. Yeah, I remember you telling me that. You're like, bro, you could host a show. You could do this. I
was like, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
You and Tiffany Haddish, I called y'all correctly. I will always take pride in knowing you and Tiffany Haddish. I knew when I saw y'all in y'all element what y'all path was going to be, at least up to this point. I knew Tiffany was going to pop in movies. I knew you was going to be a phenomenal host and kill it in that field. But I remember we was at Marty's. We was outside on the steps.
Yeah.
And Utah, Marty's is a open mic spot that was popping in LA at one time. A lot of comedians used to go there and work out their material. Yeah. And you told me like, yo, I just got The Daily Show. And I was like, it made so much sense to me. I'm like, I knew it. Fucking knew it. I was like, they need you. I remember saying, I don't know if you remember that, but I was like, they need you. I was like, they need your perspective. They need somebody from your cultural background to speak on this platform and deliver that type of commentary. I was like, they fucking need you, yo. And from that to what you went on to after that, I mean, man, but that moment really stands out because in my mind, I was like, Hassan's about to be out of here. I'm like, that's all he needed. All he needed was a daily show for people to see how great he is and what he's about to accomplish.
That means a lot. Thank you, bro. I remember that day. And I just, you know, it's one of those things, man. Like, again, you don't see it that way. You get off the phone with like your agent or your manager, my manager at the time, and they're just like, so Comedy Central gave you a 3-month contract. You know what I mean? So I'm on a rookie contract. That's all you're thinking about. And, you know, I'm thinking about, all right, how am I gonna get Bina out to New York? We had just gotten married. Like, all right, so I got this 3-month contract. Yo, is John gonna keep me? Is he gonna fire me? You have all those things. Am I gonna be able to make it in New York? Those are all the thoughts that were like swirling through my head. But yeah, man, you did call it. I remember you saying that to me. It's just wild.
Yeah, man.
Have you always had that confidence? Have you always just been like, I know it's gonna be like this. I just know it.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Really?
Because I'm gonna tell you when I don't though. Wait a minute. And this one I'm gonna speak on behalf of the importance of having a great woman in your corner.
Right.
There's nothing like a woman that will uplift you when you're in your darkest times. My wife has been there. There's definitely been days when something don't go right, I'm on the cusp of something major and everything just tumbled. Rush Hour, you know, here you are, here I am, the lead of a network show, and then certain things not adding up. This is supposed to be the biggest show of the season on network TV. It go from being a fall premiere to a mid-season premiere. It goes for having supposed to have this big rollout to having this very small rollout when it comes to press, and you start seeing things and you're like, wait a minute, and then it gets canceled during the commercial break, you know. You know, and so here you are, like, you like, finally I'm about to be at the fuck. See, in my mind I'm like, oh, I'm about to be out of here. I'm like, I do Rush Hour for 5 seasons, it's a wrap. I'm like, yo, after that it's on to movies, I'm straight. And then the shit get canceled. And then you like, God damn. And then that's when the confidence leaves, because then you start thinking like, damn, am I as good as I think I am? Like, what is it about me that didn't work? What was it about the show that maybe didn't work? And you start questioning, you know, and then you start looking at time. You start looking at the clock is ticking. When I book Rush Hour, I'm 29. I'm like, I'm right on schedule. I know all the greatest comedians pop at 30. So when I book Rush Hour at 29, I'm right on fucking schedule. This is how this shit is working. Supposed to go this way. And then the shit get canceled. Like, oh shit. So I said all of that to say, then I have my wife. So when I don't have that confidence, she's the one that says, Justin, you got this. You go, you as great as you think you are, you got to just keep going, continue to be strong, and you're going to get to the other side. You know, you go get to all the things you want to accomplish. But as a child and kid, yeah, I mean, I was always like, yo, I'm going to do this shit. I'm like, I'm moving to LA after I graduate. I'm going to fucking get on TV. Yo, I won most humorous in elementary and high school. I won most likely to be in a movie in middle school.
Oh, right. So you were always the funniest kid, like flat out.
Yeah.
And you were doing impressions. You were doing everything, right?
Yeah.
That makes sense, bro. Yeah. So it was just in you, bro. You're just like, it's in me. Like,
but see, that's also the struggle in me because, and I want to know if you ever felt this way before The Daily Show and Patriot Act.
Right, right.
When you see everyone else, quote unquote, winning or working, and the only thing that stands out to me is the Kanye verse is, damn, are these niggas that much better than me?
Right, right.
Have you ever experienced that?
Man, I mean, so there were multiple, like, little phases of my career pre-2014, pre-Daily Show. And I'll tell you kind of the light bulb moment that I had then. Pre-Daily Show, I was part of what I call just, like, the Hollywood grind machine, like get in my dented Toyota Camry, go to Marty's, pay my $5 to do my material, right? Like I would see like you, Paul, Aaliyah, like, you know what I'm saying? go drive all the way across LA to go to Santa Monica to be in a Pizza Hut commercial or some shit, you know? And then, you know, go up to Burbank and go audition for the untitled Adam Cezekiel pilot. This is your life. You're just like this, like atom colliding randomly in the universe, and you're hoping something will connect and combust, right? And once I got to The Daily Show, and I was a part of like that kind of, political, you know, very prestigious program, I just saw the way John, Stephen, John Oliver, some of the SNL guys, I saw the way they moved, and I realized, yo, they're not just spending their days randomly trying to ask for work. They're spending their days imprinting their worldview on the world. So like, you know, John and Steven did that big special in Washington, D.C., like where it was like John versus Steven. They did that. Like I got to see like SNL guys, they would leave and then go write a movie and then produce it and go run and do that. They were spending their days not auditioning. They were just like, you know, pen to paper, writing out an entire project, producing that project and bringing it to market. And I was like, yeah, that's what my life has to be. Like, I can't waste my time anymore trying to fit in on, you know, a fourth tier pilot where all the A-list stars have passed on it and now they're going to go ethnic with it. So they could cast it me or Justin or, you know what I'm saying, any Roy Wood Jr., any one of our friends. That's not the project that's going to make you. I realized I was like, oh, John is one of the greatest of all time at this because this suit is specifically tailored to him. Mm. You know, so-and-so, you know, Kate McKinnon is a beast on this show because her sketches are specifically tailored to her. So I had to really start thinking about, all right, what are the things that I'm doing that are one of one? Only I can do them. Like, if any you try to cast anybody else, yo, this thing doesn't quite work. It just would not come off right. And that's what I've spent the last 7 years of my like career doing, whether it was Homecoming King, whether it was Patriot Act, those things I'm really proud of because it's just like, I put everything of me into it. It's just me. It's so awesome, you know? And that's my thing. The doubt comes in when I get opportunities to do new or different things and I'm stretching myself a little bit. Like I'm on the show this season called The Morning Show. You know, and I'm on screen with Reese Witherspoon and Jen Aniston, and that checks me every day because I'm just like, yo, can I hang with these guys? You know,
which you can.
Yeah, but so what gives you that confidence? What gives you that confidence when you're on set where you're like, bro, I'm gonna do great. I'm gonna hit my mark. I'm gonna do great here. Even when you're not writing the lines, it's not like, you know what I'm saying? It's not
right.
You didn't write the lines, the punchlines, or the tags. You're just like.
Preparation.
I mean, I'm doing a diversity showcase with you. You have, this is just props to you. you and Tiffany have this innate thing, and John would talk about this with Steve Carell. You can elevate material. So I can give you this line, and it can be, you know, average. And I could be like, give it to Tiffany or give it to Justin. They'll take a 6 out of 10 and take it to an 8 out of 10. If I gave you 9 out of 10, if I gave you Aaron Sorkin material, I know Justin's going to make that a fucking 12 out of 10. Your ability to elevate material. So there's times where I've been, the doubt comes in where I'm like, yo, this writing is a 6 out of 10. And I'm only maximum taking it to a 7 out of 10. That's where the waswasa, the whisper of doubt comes over me.
And you feel you only can take it to a 7 out of 10 because of your talent level when it comes to acting? Or are you saying the writing is so poor that it can only
It could be a little bit of both. You know, one of the interesting things is I've spent, all, you know, 7-8 years of my life, you know, writing, producing, and being on things that I've completely written now. Now I'm in this new part of my career where I'm doing ensemble pieces where it's not my writing. I'm part of somebody else's greater vision. And that's very, it makes me very vulnerable. I'm just like, damn, okay. I'm putting it all on your vision. All right.
Why are you doing that? Other than your agent.
No, for me, man, is like, you know, it took me 10 years, 1 month, and 9 days to get The Daily Show. I've been doing from Dave Chappelle to there. That was 10 years, 1 month, and 9 days. Then when I got to Hollywood in 2009, that was like 4 or 5 years of just like Marty's and Bruco and nobody fucking with you. So when you're in the zone, when you have that window of opportunity, you do have to take advantage of it. And so what I wanted to ask myself is like, yo, if I do have this opportunity, I do want to do projects where it's going to force me to put 45 pounds on each side of the bench press. Like it's going to force me to up my weight. And I want to see what it's like to fly at that altitude. You know what I mean? Like Apple is spending the most amount of money on that show. I want to see if I can fly at that altitude with those actors and actresses. Like, yo, Billy Crudup is a beast. Reese Witherspoon is a beast. These people are beasts, you know? And I want to run with them. So that's what it's about. It's that fight. Like, yo, I want to see if this is in me. Is this in me? You know what I'm saying?
No, for sure. I was going to tell you, because I don't know if...
Clout hype aside, like, it's that challenge. Yo, is this in me? You know?
Yeah, man. Well, you've definitely proven, of course, when it comes to hosting that, you know, you that dude, for sure. I mean, there's... And I got a few questions to ask you, because, you know, I don't get to talk to you often, man. But... One is, to answer your question, what gives me that confidence? Even when I did Rush Hour, people was asking me, like, are you nervous stepping into Chris Tucker's shoes?
Yes.
My answer was always no, because I know I put in the work and preparation for me to land this. Like, every comedian, every black comedian, actor, and musician auditioned for this role.
Yeah.
It's like, they didn't get it. Yeah. But it was only because I put in one naturally where I'm in that vein. I'm from the school of Chris Tucker, Martin Lawrence type vein, Eddie Murphy. You know, I'm from that vein anyways. However, though, I knew I put in the work for me to be ready for that. So I say that even for you, you know, you can elevate it. You can elevate anything, because even when I elevate material, it's partly performance. But yeah, I throw in my own tags. I throw in some improv. So MacGyver, I did MacGyver for 5 years. It just ended. But even in that show, it was throwing in my own ad-libs, throwing in the tag, throwing in different physical things or different looks, you right. know? So right. you somebody, even a look, you know, you could give a look or something, or a certain, you know, whatever, and yeah. that could elevate something.
There you go. I got you.
Yeah, man.
And what's great is, man, the thing I'm really excited about is the more time you have on set like that, you just get more confidence. You know what it is. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, for sure. Oh, yeah. For sure, man. What was the morning show an offer?
Morning show was an audition. So that was really cool too, man. Like, you know, I knew I was in the running. And look, like, there's certain roles where you know you're in the strike zone. Bro, I've spent 7 years being a fake news anchor. You want me to go? You want me to go be a fake news anchor?
Right, straight up, straight up.
And by the way, shout out to Chris Rock. I told Chris Rock about it when I got it, because he was doing Fargo. I was like, bro, this is my first time doing a drama. Like, you know, and if anybody's seen the show, it's drama. Like, this is like, it's like soap opera kind of. It's very dramatic, right? And Chris was like, bro, you're more of a news anchor than they are. Like, they have to act. You don't have to act. You look like you could be a news anchor. So I was like, oh, that's such a good point. Like, for all of them, they got to be like, okay, I'm a movie star. I got to, what would it be like if I was on a news set? Where I was like, bro, that's been my life for like 8 years. Like, yeah, I already know what that's like.
Come on, man. Already know. You is that. They got to pretend that, you know. that's hilarious. Great. Shout out to Chris Rock, man. Yeah.
And by the way, man, you know what's so beautiful about Chris? People don't say this enough. Like, he still keeps in touch with what younger artists are doing. Bro, he knows, like, he's like, I saw Homecoming King. I'm like, bro, why would you have the time to see it? Think about somebody at his level too. Like, you think about his last special, he had Bo Burnham direct it. Think about that, bro. He's 25 years older than this kid. This kid's like, at the time, maybe 28, 29. For a legend who's on the Mount Rushmore of comedy to humble himself and be like, no, you can bring something new out of me. I hope I'm still that curious. That humble and that passionate when I'm that age.
Yeah, I mean, I think you will be, and that's what it is. I think he's wise enough to know that if you want to stay relevant, to listen to what young people have to say. You find the smartest, youngest person you could find and see what they think. That's another, I keep bringing up Kanye, but that's something that Kanye said also, you know.
And by the way, Kanye's phenomenal about that too. Like, he was having Travis Scott, all these guys around him years before Travis was like the biggest rapper in the world. Just
Kid Cudi, had Kid Cudi around.
Yeah, that influence, yeah.
Yeah, nah, I had dinner with him one time. I'm sure Chris will never remember this. But after we had dinner, man, and I got to get to what you about to do with your next tour. But because you're performing at the venue I saw Chris at last, which blew my mind, you know. And I know you in the thick of it.
Yeah.
But that should, and if it doesn't blow your mind, I get it. But outside looking in, I'm like, when I looked at your tour dates yesterday, and I'm like, he's performing at the Straw Center in Tampa. Like, I saw Chris Rock there 3 years ago when he was doing his Total Blackout tour. Like, that's a huge fucking venue to be doing. And I'm like, Hassan, it lets you know that it's possible. It lets you know if you put in the work and you're talented and you're a good person, you could get that. You know what I'm saying? But while I was having dinner, because we went out to dinner with him afterwards, after the show.
Yeah.
And at the end of the dinner, I told Chris, I said, hey, man, I just want to thank you for allowing me and my wife to, you know, come here and have dinner with you. And he was like, come on, man. He's like, man, Eddie used to let me stick around, you know. But he was just referring to, like, you a young comic. Eddie Murphy used to let me tag along. So, yeah, man, you know, I'm going to show love to you. And I thought that spoke volumes, you know, of his character and humility and how good of a person he is. I want to talk about Homecoming King and Patriot. And not Patriot. I want to talk about Homecoming King and the King's Jester, your new.
Yeah.
And when did they decide, Netflix, or did you shoot it first? I don't know what happened.
Sure.
How did you get the special? Like, what moments led up to you getting that?
Yeah, bro. So I'll tell you something. So, and this is a great conversation, and I'm so glad, like, because we know each other for years, I can have it with you. You know, you ever feel this as an artist? Like, there's stuff that you're doing, like, you're shooting MacGyver, right? And every day, you guys shoot it in Atlanta, right? So you're
right.
Like, living in Atlanta, you got your apartment. You're going through the rigmarole, right? Like, oh, here, Justin, here's your coffee. Here's your blah, blah, blah. You go to your breakfast spot. You're in kind of the doldrums of your day-to-day life, right? But then there's just this notebook that you have on the side, and it's just filled with all these ideas, whether it was rap, whatever it is. It's poetry, a script. It's this thing that's pouring out of you, right? And so I remember, you know, I'm getting up. This is in 2010, 2011. I'm still in LA. I'm getting up at the Improv. I'm getting up at the Haha. I'm getting up, you know, at Marty's Laugh Factory. I'm auditioning for Montreal. And I keep seeing, I'm like, you know, there's these pure stand-ups, like just the pure raw, like they go from joke to joke to joke, 7-minute set. and they're crushing. And I'm all right. I'm cool. Like, it's not that I'm bad. It's not that I'm bombing. But there's a difference, bro, between like a Ferrari and a 3 Series. You know what I'm saying? Just that engine runs different, you know? And the 3 Series is nice and it's cool, whatever, right? But my engine couldn't rev like that. Like, I couldn't crush as like the way some of these guys and my contemporaries were doing new innovative things in the stand-up space that way. So I started doing these like storytelling shows, which like a lot of comedians weren't hanging out at, but people like Mike Birbiglia, Colin Quinn, they had pivoted. I started hearing them on NPR. They were doing these like longer like stories, right? And I started going to the Moth Story Slam and these other places. And bro, then I was crushing. Like, I was crushing in a way nobody else was crushing, because the pure storytellers in theater, they're just telling these like long sob stories, but they're not tagging it. They're not having asides, you know, they're not building the roller coaster. You know what I'm saying? So I remember in 2011, 2012, I started telling the early stories from Homecoming King, which become Homecoming King. And I had this killer story about my prom experience. Anyways, that was an important moment for me where a lot of my friends that were around me were telling me, they're like, bro, you have a gift for this. And you know, shout out to Steve Harvey. Steve said this, like, you know, when people say follow your passions, they're actually wrong. You should follow your gift. I think my whole journey in life is figuring out what are my gifts? What are the things that God gave me? So I'm passionate about basketball, bro. But if you've seen me in the celebrity game, I'm not very good. I'm very passionate though. You know what I'm saying? I'm very passionate.
When you talk about celebrityness, yeah, that's when I knew you crossed over.
Oh, the celebrity.
When I saw that, when I saw you in the NBA All-Star Celebrity, I said, this motherfucker's out of here.
Yeah. So I'm passionate about basketball, bro, but that ain't it. I'm passionate about a lot of different music, hip hop. Yeah. Great, bro, but you should not be doing that.
Right.
Your gift, you know, and Steve was describing this, was something that you naturally do that you don't really have to try that hard at. And that second part of that sentence was everything. I'm like, we all have that thing. We all have that friend that was really good at calculus, didn't even study for the test. We all have that friend that was like, yo, she can sing. Bro, she's hungover from the night before and she can still sing better than any of you girls. We all have that friend that's like, yo, he can eat a whole large pizza the day before. He lifts up his shirt, he's got an 8-pack. His metabolism is his gift. He's not even trying, right? Now, if you put work on top of that gift, you're out of this world. You're like, yeah, you're actually one of one. You're Adele. You're a superstar. You're LeBron. Yeah, you're LeBron. You're just bro, I've seen LeBron. His shoulders are like here. Mav's shoulders are here. You know what I'm saying? He's already built like a tank. That's from God.
Right.
Now, if you put work on top of that, that's already his gift. Now he's one of one, right?
Straight up.
And so I was thinking about this. I was like, bro, I'm smoking people at these storytelling shows. The separation between number one and two is vast. What if I really doubled and tripled down? So I took the show when I finally got to New York. I was like, I'm going to take the show off Broadway. Everybody on Broadway.
Wait a minute. Is this during the Daily Show? You're doing this? Okay. Yeah.
So this is my thing. I'm just like, again, once again, you know, I'm on the Daily Show and I'm starting to figure out what's my gift. Like, and I realized I'm part of an ensemble cast. There's 5 correspondents. You know, I'm going to be on the show a few times, maybe a couple times a week, maybe several times a month, right? When John needs me to come in and hit something out of the park, right? I'm going to go shoot field pieces. But with all this extra time, I want to build myself in New York. And so I started going to the Cellar, and then I started building up this off-Broadway show at Cherry Lane Theater. You know, Comedy Central had passed on my, you know, I wanted to do a half hour. They had passed. Everybody had kind of passed. So I took some money, and again, I got to give a shout out to my wife, because when you're married, that's your joint bank account. And we took $27,000 out of that bank account, and we put up the first, you know, kind of rent production payment for the theater. And then we took out another $25,000 to shoot like a mini special. And bro, that was all the money we how much Comedy Central, these places pay. Like, it was that plus some of my extra savings. And we shot this like mini proof of concept, and I put it up on Vimeo, and then I shopped it around in real time as the show was selling out in New York. So I could feel a buzz building. And then I was like, as soon as the buzz builds, be ready, shop this around, you know? And shout out to Kristen Zollner at Netflix. I ended up showing her the proof of concept of act 2 of the show, and she bought it. She was like, yeah, I really like this.
Wow.
And yeah, bro. And so that was like the second time in my like life where, again, just I built the whole ship. And then, you know, they believed. And in the proof of concept I showed, I did like 3D rendering so I could show how, like, if I was standing on stage, the graphics would come in front of me, behind me. Like, you see that in Homecoming King. So Zollner could see, like, oh, I see the direction. I see the vision of what he's trying to do. But she could press play on it, you know? And so that was the power of, you know, someone believing you internally, in you internally, and showing them, not telling them, showing them what it could be. And then third, just having like a supportive wife, bro. Like that wouldn't have been possible without her. And so that was it. That it ended up getting sold. And then I knew, okay, if I get this shot, I get a Netflix special. I know the reach these things have. All right, I'm going to swing for the fences. Like I'm going to, you know, work with the best lighting designers, the best stage designers. And it's funny, there were some other comics that were like, bro, comedy specials aren't supposed to look like this. It's not supposed to be you in front of like CNN screens. And it was that same thing. I'm like, I know, but I'm not you. Like, I'm not Justin. I'm not Tiffany. Like, I don't have what they have. I have this other thing that's in me. So I want to show the world that thing, you know?
And man, it really clicked. That was probably my favorite special that year. I don't remember what other specials came out that year, but I remember seeing that thinking, this is a classic. It's a classic. You created a classic, which is so hard. Yeah. For a comedian to do, even if it's a one-man show, even like, I don't know, like John Leguizamo has created a classic with Freak. Whoopi yeah. Goldberg created a classic. Like, there's a very few caliber of, like, talent comedians that created, like, a one-man show classic. But you did that, man. Man, when you did these off-Broadway shows, because this is something that I always thought was very impressive by you. How many people was coming out to these shows originally? Because you always, for me, outside, again, this is outside looking in, it's like, I felt like you skipped the club shows. Like most comedians, if you don't know, you do open mics, you start featuring for somebody, you start headlining, now you're headlining clubs, and then when you get big enough, you go to the theaters, like the bigger, and then you fucking hit the arenas. But I don't remember you headlining clubs.
Yeah, it was one of those things where, the clubs that I was getting offers at, like, were like the C clubs, like, you know, like way off the beaten path in Spokane, Washington. And I had done a couple of them. And I remember thinking to myself, I was like, you know, no disrespect, but I saw the audience. I saw the people that were coming out. I saw that they had just papered a lot of the room. And I was like, bro, I could spend a decade of my life here. There's no way I'm going to build a real substantial fan base this way. Shout out to the other comics that can. There's other comics that really built it that way.
But it takes years for them to build it that way, like 20 years for them to build it like that.
Yeah, but I'm like, this isn't going to work for me, for my skill set. So what I did, and it's funny that you say that, like maybe the perception from the outside was like, bro, like my man got a show going off Broadway. This is crazy. But I was just dealing with in my head, bro, you're 30 grand in debt. You got to make sure that you recoup. So it started with, you know, just 100 people showing up. And then, you know, it was an off-Broadway theater. So it was like maybe capacity 300, 350 maybe. So like 100 people show up, the back 200 aren't there, but you really resonate. They start telling their friends, their cousins, their mom, you know, and the culture didn't have something like that. Nobody had told the story of New Brown America like that, from that perspective. And it went from 100, 125, 200, and then we started selling them out, you know.
How quickly was that jump?
That jump, it took about, that was about a month. So the first week was a paper. The second week it got bigger. The third week it got a little bit bigger. And fourth week it got a little bit bigger. And I realized the power of, you know, storytelling. That to me was the X factor. Like, if you can tell a great story that's very personal and meaningful and they feel a connection to you, everybody's got a friend, a cousin, a sister, a brother that's like, yo, instead of going to the movies, you gotta go to the show. It's just, it'll move you in a way that like you did, you know, you haven't seen before. And that was a big life lesson for me where I was like, yo, jokes are cool, but jokes will take you to here. If you can tell jokes in a story, you're gonna be at the next level. And I realized, I didn't know this, nobody told me this. All the greatest stand-up comics that really pop are storytellers. Look at the biggest arena comics right now and from the past. You have Cosby. You have Pryor, you have Chappelle, you have Sebastian Maniscalco, you have all these guys that are, you know, Kevin Hart, they're all telling stories. Sebastian tells stories. Kevin Hart tells stories. Joe Coy tells stories, right? They're all storytellers. And I didn't know that. And then it clicked for me in that moment where I'm like, you tell a great, compelling story with jokes in it. You've really established a vulnerable connection with people. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Whew, man. I mean, these are facts. Patriot Act, because I thought that was something that you did that I didn't know you did when I listened to your interview with Kevin Hart, which was the same thing that you're saying you did with Homecoming King, which is you paid for the pilot, right? So I guess now I didn't know that about Homecoming King. So I guess you saw that work with Homecoming King. So now your thought is now I'm going to do the same thing with Patriot Act. Let me go and shoot it and show them what my vision is for this show.
Let me put it this way, man. Like, it's, I think the one thing that I've been lucky enough, maybe that's been my gift, is I can recognize when you're in the strike zone. What I mean by that is this. Like, I'm just like, say you're at the BMW dealership, you got a 3 Series, right? But you know you're right underneath a 5 Series, right? You're like, yo, I could upgrade right now to a 5 Series. It's within reach. A lot of people, they try to go from, you know, like, I'm at Marty's, I want to be number one on the call sheet in a Universal studio film. So that leap is too big. But you could go from Marty's to like Wildin' Out. You could go from Wildin' Out to then maybe like your own show on MTV or Over and Overall, and then you could maybe be in an ensemble. Like, it's understanding what the next monkey bar is. So I knew when I was at the Daily Show, Homecoming King had just was about to come out, and I had just done the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So I was like, you know, no disrespect, but I know what reality is. I'm like, yo, you're gonna be hot and talked about right now for like a month. You got like a month, like, where everybody's like, yo, you the guy, and then everybody's gonna know, like, yeah, you're funny, but you're not that funny. Like, that's what, to me, like, hype is. Like, hype is, yo, this person's really good, but you're getting more than what you really, really kind of deserve. Not trying to be, like, disrespectful about it. I knew that even about myself. So I knew, bro, you're going to get any meeting you want in town. Now, you could go take those meetings. And I had a lot of friends that got bad pilots or they got bad shows because they had a vision in their head. And they told it to the executives and they told it to the people. And by the time the whole thing gets built and you actually see what it was on Comedy Central, on MTV, you're like, bro, this looks like everything else. Mm-hmm. Once again, I knew, I'm like, I know what my specific suit is. I know the type of show I can pull off. So I went to Bina again and I was like, I know we saved up this Comedy Central money. I know we saved up some of your money. Like, can we please, I feel like this is, I'll never be the new kid like this in 2017 again. Like, the way it was in April 29, 2017, my life was different than the following day after I did the Correspondents' Dinner. Shit was just different. So I said, please, let me take these next 4 or 5 months while I have this heat. Let's go shoot this proof of concept. And I did that with my writing and producing partner, Prashant. We did it. And I went all in, and it paid off. That being said, it was a calculated risk. I didn't just go all in and then decide to like shoot like a very niche, you know, indie drama. It wasn't that. I didn't hard pivot. It was like the next logical jump. You know what I'm saying?
What do you feel? I got to tell you, because I want to give you your flowers, man, while you're here. You know what I'm saying? I know other people probably sang your praises, but this is coming from like a peer, and this is coming from, I've seen the journey of you. This is when I knew you was great. It was two very like definitive moments that I saw you. One was it was an MTV showcase at the Laugh Factory. And I don't know, you was doing your set, and I don't know if the crowd was really fucking with you at first, that the crowd wasn't really on your side. And then you kind of feel like just went off script.
Yeah, I was like, what is this? Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And you destroyed. After you was just like, you called out them for their bullshit, the audience, and I'm talking about you lit fire on their ass. And I was like, that was my first time, like, oh, I was like, Hassan's a beast. That's when I first saw it. The right. Second moment was you was touring Homecoming King, and you came to Atlanta, and I hit you up, you gave me some tickets.
I remember that, yeah.
And I came through in the last, first of all, I was impressed that it was sold out. That's when I was like, well, when the fuck, when did this happen? You know, because I'm like, he ain't been like performing at no improvs. So how did, that's why I asked you that question. I'm like, how did this even happen that he has this large of a fan base?
Right, right.
So you destroyed. I'm talking about thunderous laughter throughout. Then it was heartfelt. And I was like, yo, I was like, he's going to go down as one of the greats, you know? I mean that, because when I saw that with my own two eyes, those two moments, I was like, this is some other level shit. This is some stuff that people, very few people can get laughs that hard and it not be hacky and it be something personal and something that really touch you. It's very few people that could do that, man. So when you did that, I thought that was incredible. When it comes to Brown, and when you say Brown, because I don't know, this is a true ignorant question. I don't know.
Yeah.
Are you Indian? Do you want to say, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But you all just say Brown.
Yeah. And I mean, and like by that, I mean also like, you know, like when we talk about race in America, we think about it's black and white, but there's also Latino Americans. There's also like Southeast Asians, right? There's South Asians like me, Indian, Pakistani, that, right? There's Filipino, Chinese. There's all these, this new mix of like immigrants in the US, right? And that's what I mean by that, like that, like what I mean, like collectively brown. But by brown, I mean, yeah, like Indian.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. I'm Negro, everybody, in case you're wondering. but
you know what's funny, man? Like sometimes when I'm like, I'm in hair and makeup, right? And like the makeup artist is black, I'm like, yo, we're brown. Because like the MAC makeup you need on you is the same that you need on me. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's that same, like, we're in the same, like, MAC makeup range. You know,
oh, for sure. For
like,
sure.
It's basically a group of people where I call them, like, turn the flash on, please. Like, people, like, so white people don't know that. You actually have to have flash for, like, me or you to show up in a photo at night.
Oh, yeah. The worst is, like, when you're kicking it with a group of white people. They're like, we don't need flash. We got it. And you're like, no, motherfucker, we don't got it. You got it.
I'm not gonna show up. Yeah.
You and your red eyes go show up. Remember that was a thing? Like, all white people had, like, red eyes and, like, old films. They fixed that, I think. I don't see it anymore.
Yeah.
But I was like, what the fuck is – what's going on with y'all? shout out to the white people. Indian. I brought that up because Indian comedians – so I heard Russell Peters say on the podcast that you opened up for him. Like, yeah. I don't know when this was. What point of your career was this at when you opened up for Russell Peters?
I was still in Sacramento at the time. I was still in college. So I was, bro, and that was crazy. Shout out to Russell, like, for him to be so kind. He came to the Sac Punchline, and I begged like Molly the Booker, like, yo, please let me open for him. Like, I have to. Like, he was the one, you know, he was like the biggest, you know, Indian comedian in the world. And so when I finally got to meet him, you know how those things can go. It can go left, right, or center. It can go really bad, especially when, you know, he was at that level. He was doing arenas and theaters, and you know, it could be one of those things where it's like, yo, don't come in the green room, like,
right,
you're open, but you stay there, right? Oh man, like, he got my parents tickets. He was just so cool. And I told Kevin this on the podcast, like, he's like, and next time you come to LA, you can come out and stay with me. And that was one of those things where it's just like, I felt like a kid in a Bronx Tale, you know, like, I'm going to go see Sonny. He lets me hold his watch, you know, like, I can ride around in a car with him. I just got to see what you could do. And that was really cool. And so shout out to Russell for just being a real one, you know?
Yeah. He said, did you hear his episode with Kevin? He was like, Hassan was like this nerdy kid. And he said, I had no idea he was going to grow into this handsome sex symbol. that because you are for sure the most handsome comedian in the history of, no one wears a suit better than you. It's very impressive. Do you feel like, is there ever a time, and I don't know if this is a conversation that Indian comedians have.
Right.
Do you all ever talk about doing something together like y'all version of Kings of Comedy? Or, that would be dope.
Go ahead, or what?
Or are you thinking more of the Kevin Hart route, which is, nah, I don't need y'all. I could do this shit. I'm already close to arenas, so I could just do this on my own.
No, you know, so it's so funny. Like, we did Goatface, which was a sketch show, and that was like all kind of like brown, Middle East types, like vibes and sketches and themes, and that was really cool. So I love doing stuff for the culture. One of the things that I can't wait to do, and this has just been a real modern development, man, is like, because of YouTube, the world, and you know, I got to be on The Daily Show with Trevor too. Trevor Noah showed me how big the world is, you know, like, he showed me, you know, amazing comedians that are from the UK. He showed me there's so many amazing comedians that are in South Africa. And so I started thinking about it that way. I was like, yo, I should, you know, now that the world is opening up, I should go to India and do shows with comics out there. I should bring some of them out here. You know, we're doing Radio City. I should have a couple of them pull. I should have Russell pull up, like, just to do it. It's not a money thing. It's just to do it for the culture, just to do it.
You're doing Radio City.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah.
Do that blow your mind, or when you get, or you think when you get there, you might be like, holy shit, I'm doing Radio City.
So, you know, like right now I'm in just a janky ass Sheraton in Memphis. Like, bro, I mean, there's like stains on the couch. I mean, I don't know what that stain is right there. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I'm gonna be honest. I would think somebody at your level might be in suites at this point.
No, I'm just like, you know, I'm just booking whatever. And I'm just like, I got it. But to me, bro, it's this, man. This is what I'm knee deep in, right? You know what I'm saying? I'm just knee deep in the script. That's all I'm sweating. You know, I'm just like, it's got to be worthy of that. The last thing I want to do, bro, is just to be all frills, all, you know, I'm wearing a leather suit or whatever. And then it's just a seat. Like, everybody leaves the show and they're just like, it was all right.
How are you feeling so far?
Right. So, you know, here we are. I'm talking to you. It's June 12th. Tour starts September 17th. So I'm feeling good, but there's a big gap between good, you know, great and phenomenal. That's what I'm trying to traverse, you know?
And when you did Homecoming King, you was on some phenomenal
shit. I was like, we're somewhere between great and phenomenal. This show is great. Like, it is resonating with people as whatever. The phenomenal thing, that's out of your hands. That to me is divine destiny.
Yeah.
You have to strike some chord in their heart that makes them feel a certain way. I try not to think about that, because you don't want to work backwards. Like, oh, this is going to go viral. You don't want to operate from that. You want to come from a true place. You know.
In your reps, arena. Hold on. I want to. How close do you think you are to doing arenas?
I mean, in New York, we could have done it in New York. We could have done Madison Square Garden. Yeah.
Yeah. Man.
Surreal. Yeah. I mean. Like, so two Radio Cities is 14,000. Madison Square is like, you know, 17. So we're close. You know, it's right there. You know,
I see it, man. I see it. When I saw Homecoming King, I was like, damn. But when I saw your new tour dates and I saw the venues you were doing, I'm like, honestly, I mean, if anything, one special away. You know, after this next one, I would think you got it. You know.
But do you think, just honestly, do you think comedy's supposed to be in arenas?
No, because I'm gonna be honest. I think Chappelle does it right. The level of the venues, the Radio Cities,
yeah.
You know, when he's in Atlanta at the Tabernacle.
Yeah.
I think if anything, that's probably as big as stand-up probably should be.
Yeah. That's what I think. So I think arenas, those are cool. Those are a flex. But, you know, again, like, I'm getting older, bro. I'm 35, right? So I'm just about honoring the art form at this point. You know, me, you know, dad to dad, husband to husband. I got two responsibilities. I got to make sure the bag is correct for the family. You know what I mean? And family is really big for me. And just taking care of them is very important. And the second thing is, bro, I know, like, I'm 30. I'm not going to be Zac Efron. Like, I'm not the young, good-looking Indian kid. I'm an older dude. I'm entering this new era where I want to do really great art from a wise, you know, position in POV. Like, that's what I'm trying to make, really good artistic choices. And so I think as a kid, I'd be like, bro, I've always wanted to do an arena. But there's part of me that's also like, are you honoring the art form? Or are you just doing this for ego? Like, that is this just a flex? Like, if it's a flex, go flex. But are you going to give everybody in that stadium a really good show? I even think, you know, I've seen shows. I bought tickets to go see Chappelle and Rock at Radio City. And I sat kind of far in the back and I'm like, damn, these are big rooms. You got to give them a show. You got to give people a show.
Yeah. So this is it, man. Where do you want to see yourself like 5-10 years from now? Like, what other things are you going to accomplish or would like to accomplish? But I see you accomplishing everything you set out to do.
Man, God willing, I just want to, you know, it's funny, like, you know, back in the Marty's days, it's so funny that you saw all these things in me. Bro, I can't tell you how many times I would be in that, like, Marty's parking lot, just straight up crying in that dented Camry. I can't tell you, bro, like.
Wow.
Yeah, man, because it was just like, you're testing for this pilot, it doesn't go your way. And, you know, at that time, again, you know, just something to consider. You don't know what somebody else is going through. So I had gotten into law school. And I had gotten into a good law school. I had gotten into like UCLA and USC. I'm on the wait list. You know, all I got to do is just petition to get in. I can get in. And I'm, you know, I'm going through it. I'm like, I can't book a pilot. You know, maybe, you know, once every, you know, 8-9 months, I book a commercial and that just gives me enough rent to get through the next thing. I'm on disaster date. Like, am I really going to throw a real career away to be on disaster day? What if that's all that's destined for me, right? And so that time, you know, I was really struggling with, bro, they're not picking me. What if I never get picked? And I think the new chapter, what I hope to do with my career is, I'm just doing projects where I'm like, I don't care if you don't have to pick me. This is happening whether you want it to or not. So I hope to continue to write and produce film and television on my terms. I'll write it, I'll produce it, I'll put up the bag and we'll put it out. You know, I'm going to do one-man shows and theater tours on my terms. I'll write it. I'll produce it. I'll hire the lighting designer, the stage director, the director, all of that stuff. And because I don't want to live my life waiting to be picked anymore. So that's my mission and goal, just to produce and make my own vision of the world.
Straight up. Oh, okay. Late night talk show. Would you ever do a late night talk show?
But I did pick you. You're talking about like a daily show?
Yeah, I mean like the Tonight Show type thing. Or are you over talk? Or are you over that? Are you over the hosting type thing?
You know, it's interesting. Like, you know, something I was thinking about that'd be really fun, bro. I'd love to host Jeopardy just as a guest host. But like, bro, like for like six, because I would love to bring like humor to it a little bit too. Like, it's this like beautiful, like amazing American institution, and then I could bring this like youthful comedic energy to it in a good way. It's like nerd shit and comedy all in one. Like, I feel like that would, I could so do that.
They would do that if you asked them.
I told Bina that, and Bina's like, yo, do that when you're 50. I was like, bro, it'd be kind of fun just for like 6 months. I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. And I promise you this is the last one, because this is it.
No, go ahead.
SNL. Why haven't you done it? What's the struggle?
That would be my dream. Like, it would be a dream to host SNL, and I would love, like, I would pour my heart into that monologue. I can't wait. The SNL monologue to me, that's everything. Like, the SNL monologue to me is everything.
All right, well, at least you know I didn't hold you for no bullshit questions, but because I watched SNL, and I seen when Donald Glover did it and Issa Rae did it. I said, Hassan is in that same bag. Where is he?
You know what it is? You just have to be anchoring a big project. So, you know, like when they do the hosts, minus a few comedians, it's usually like Timothée Chalamet is the lead of this movie, or so-and-so is in this movie and it just got nominated for an Oscar. So,
you know, I felt that for Patriot Act. I felt like that was.
Yeah, to me. Yeah. You know, but God willing, like, you know, something will happen. It'll be that right moment and I'll be ready.
For sure. I'm out of here, man. I love you. You're a king. Like I said, this is Urban Legends. We do this to celebrate people I consider living legends and making legendary moves, man. I appreciate you. And, man, just keep doing your thing, bro.
No, I ain't no Jay-Z, but you still get a J. Shooting at niggas like that nigga Clay. Invested in myself and doubled up my pay.